Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello!
Justin Robert Young.
Well, hello, friends.
And Bryce Castillo, our super producer extraordinaire.
Hi, everybody.
Well, now that we can legally say happy birthday without having to pay any royalty rights, we could sing it, but we won't. We'll just say that we did.
Hold on. Is this a this week development that they finally?
That lawsuit got settled a while ago.
Yeah. I thought so. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
But there have been no birthdays since then.
Finally, been a birthday.
We could sing happy birthday to.
I've been meaning to sing good morning to you with some words from a different poem, but that's fine.
We could do that too. Kind of this week has been kind of a cool. Week for anniversaries and stuff involving space, first and foremost. NASA turned 60 October 1st, 1958.
Happy NASA birthday. Was commissioned. Man, I'm trying to even wrap my mind around that time period where so much genuinely good exploratory science was done in the name of a weird proxy war. Like, how do you explain the space race to somebody under 20? Like, it really was a genital measuring contest.
At that point in 1958, I mean, post the launching of Sputnik, like, there's a very seductive quality to imagine the past as a version of the present, right? As like a version of the present, but with different clothes. And I think that something that is fundamentally different between now and then is how much we know about everything. Like, I literally in my Twitter account saw somebody retweet a Only in Russia Twitter handle that just like had a guy that apparently you can do 30 squats at a train station to get a free train ticket. That's how much I know about Russia right now.
Have you seen this, by the way, Bryce?
No, I haven't.
I totally have seen it. See if you can find it, because it's worth looking at. Basically, like, there's a trivial amount for a train ticket, but if you do 30 squats, you get it for free. It's amazing.
But what we did not know then, I mean, people in the government probably knew it more, but the mainstream people were exactly like, we look at the space race as kind of like a dog measuring contest, because we know. Now we have more of an idea of where the Soviet Union was financially, where they were militarily, where they were, that fraction of time. But before we really had the public had any knowledge, as soon as they launch Sputnik, as soon as they are accessing space, the idea that they could put a missile in space and send it down to Earth was as much of a reality as anything else. Like, so I do think that the space race in terms of national consciousness was not just haha, we'll beat you Ruskies. Like, that's a modern patina on what was, I think, a genuine panic.
And let me add some color, though, because we always say, oh, it was this mission. It was, yes, there was a race between us and the Russians, but part of what happened, remember, NASA was a civilian agency. Okay, NASA was formed as a civilian agency. The Army had been working on missiles. Post-World War II, a lot of those German scientists who built V-2 rockets came over here. Wernher von Braun worked for the military, worked on guided missile systems. We're working on those, okay? We started NASA. The goal of NASA was to say, we want to try to have a civilian agency, not this, not just have our military build bigger rockets. So NASA was set out to go do this. And what happened was interesting is the early days, NASA was really good at blowing up rockets. NASA was not successful. Vanguard's other stuff, they kept blowing up on the pad. And finally, we had to go to the Army and go ask for what the Redstone rocket, which was really kind of like the V2.2.0, to be honest with you, to be really honest with you. We took that, painted it like a NASA rocket, launched it, and hey, we were successful. We put, I think it was Explorer 1, into space. We really made a sincere effort at a civilian space effort. And we have consistently then. And yes, we funded it with the energy, you know, the drive to show kind of American superiority and technology and to sort of have this dominance, because there was this fear the military and the government did not take space seriously prior to Sputnik getting up there. It was just, yeah, we'll get there eventually, whatever. Then all of a sudden, one day, beep, 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 Sputnik's orbiting the Earth. And they're like, wait, the Russians can put things up there into orbit? And they're like, yeah. Like, well, the space thing sounds pretty important to me now.
Quick sidebar. Imagine what it's like at that moment when all of a sudden the mere fact of exactly one artificial satellite going over American territory, like all of a sudden I would imagine that you're like, they could just have a grid of 100,000 missiles just up there always ready to beep bop boop anyone, anytime, anywhere.
Build space stations with missiles on top of there so you don't have to worry about launching them. They're already in space. That was a realization that came in. And so the military continued its efforts. NASA was, forget what the precursor agency was to that, but then they basically formed NASA and said, this is what you're going to be. And NASA tried developing on their own, and then eventually they brought in Von Braun, et cetera. And then Von Braun went to work for NASA, and that's what Von Braun had wanted to do all along, so he says. I mean, he, you know, this is a guy that, you know, one of the greatest rocket designers there was. You know, the Russians had Kurilov, you know, had their own experts. But anyhow, there was a sincere effort towards that. And, you know, but, you know, early on they ended up being, let's use the military ones. But we have this very different, like, you know, the Air Force has their own space plane, like the X-37, whatever. Okay. NASA has, you know, funded, you know, both Boeing and SpaceX to develop crew capsules, things like this. NASA had the shuttle, but that's the thing to think about. Like, Air Force has their own space vehicles. And so we have this separate civilian effort, which I think is commendable.
And it is worth pointing out, this is 1958, so the president is Dwight Eisenhower, a non-politician, a general that is coming in as president. And if he has one legacy, I mean, again, he's the guy who coins the term military-industrial complex, because he knew not only how much the military did, but also how much the military didn't need. And you know, this is the, I think it was it is important that NASA is a civilian agency, that it wasn't just a spinoff of a military operation, because I think he understood the value of having it be outside of that structure, outside of the Pentagon.
Now, another cool anniversary, it was 10 years ago last week, SpaceX finally managed to get a rocket into orbit.
10 years ago last week?
Mm-hmm.
I
seems a lot longer.
It seems less longer to me. It seems like we've been arguing about SpaceX and then falling in love with what they achieved shorter than 10 years. But in a weird way, you know, SpaceX has been sort of one of the links of our three/four-way friendship, you know?
I look at it from the point of view of, you know, it was the Falcon 1, right, that they put up there, which is a test of their engine. I look at, like, look how far they've come in 10 years. Falcon 1, they've got their first single engine rocket payload to reach orbit. Here we are 10 years later. Okay. That is, YouTube is like 2 years older than that. Okay. Facebook is 2 years older than that. Here we are today. And they have reusable first stages using multiple reuses for that. And we talk about this, you know, a lot. There's a factory in L.A. where they're working on the Mars rocket. They're building the first fully reusable rocket, you know, upper and lower stage, in 10 years time from their first successful launch to that. It's insane. It's incredible. You know, you look at like the SLS project, you know, NASA, which, love NASA, not a fan of the bureaucracy, which is inevitable in, you know, every organization, whether it be private or public, but, you know, this doesn't work at that pace. And people are like, well, Elon Musk, you know, he exaggerates. Well, he you know, says aspirational deadlines, but 10 years from launching one single stage to reusable boosters and all that stuff, kind of.
Was that the make or break rocket? Like the one that, you know, that he had like leveraged and then releveraged if this one did not go up, it was possibly curtains for the company.
Well, you know, it was the one that was before that was their third one. They launched the third one, and the third was like, third one's like, this is it and we're done. They launched the third one, it blew up, and he's like, well, we're done. And then his engineers are like, we think we have enough parts for a fourth.
Yeah.
And then like, oh, okay. So
Yeah. I mean, it was like, you know, it was like Thanos did the snapping, you know, and then like
the snapping.
Yeah. You saw that on Reddit, right?
No, I did not. That's
amazing. Oh, you know what? There was a Thanos was right on Reddit.
Oh, that's right. And then they suddenly banned half the people who were in that subreddit. I didn't know it was called the snapping. That's fun.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's kind of very awesome as far as where we are headed, I think, right now. You know, the challenge is that in the Cold War certainly drove long-term space ambitions. It's absolutely true, because what you weren't going to get was Nixon wasn't going to come into office and kill Kennedy's moonshot program. And the moon program, like, if you look at opinion polls, was not popular at the time. Was not popular at the time among most people, because it was consuming a tremendous amount of the GDP.
But was it unpopular because people didn't believe it was possible, because it was preposterous, it was a ridiculous risk, or was it not popular because it was not relevant to the actual, like, those resources would have been, quote unquote, better spent on establishing allied territory versus, NATO versus Warsaw Pact?
I mean, for as far as Apollo, my assumption is, like, it was expensive. You know, you look what percentage of the gross domestic product or the budget, it was huge. It was a huge amount of the budget. And people go, like, you know, NASA used to have this budget. Like, yeah, NASA used to consume like 10-15% of like our budget for one single project that was not repeatable. We couldn't do again. You know, landing on the moon, most amazing achievement ever. Not gonna start doubting that. But
is it a case where it took so many resources to get to the point where we had the successful moon landing that inertia, because obviously there's a supply chain going into it. You have to build multiple versions of the Saturn V rocket and so on. Like, did we only bother to have the other moon missions because we had all the equipment laying around after having made it there first?
Well, we had planned to do this sort of continuous let's go to the moon. And the thing that happened was, like anything, the Saturn V ended up being a bit of a compromise. You know, the Saturn V borrowed heavily from Wernher von Braun, by the way, you know, his ideas for that. But it was expensive and it wasn't reusable. And in conception, I think they could think of like how, well, we'll be able to build this thing much cheaper than we expect to. But you look at costs and everything that, you know, whenever it's other people's money, your costs increase from rockets to student loans. You know, why do we have so much student loan debt? Because you can borrow the money really cheap. So colleges raise prices. You don't care. You don't complain. So colleges start building $500 million campuses and stuff and things like this and hire, you know, 120, you know, people who don't teach, you know. So, you know, these things, it's inevitable everywhere. Okay. With this, the problem was, is there was nothing going into keeping the cost down. Do you look up the cost of you know how much the moon rover costs? The moon rover, the little buggy, the moon buggy cost?
I mean, I know how much a moon or just a regular buggy is. So call that $7,000, multiply that 100 times X, call it $700,000. That seems reasonable, which as I'm speaking these words makes me think will not be the case.
Justin, we're talking the whole program, but then to deliver it. But yeah, you know, to get one of those things.
I mean, yeah, I'll go with Brian on it. I mean, like,
$700,000?
$700,000?
Like, 100 times more expensive than just a regular buggy.
Okay. Bryce?
Well, I see the number here. I looked it up for this reveal.
$400 million.
So not even, so even a 1,000x multiplier only gets us a third of the way, is that right?
So you're looking at like the actual rover costs themselves, $40 million. Okay, now you got like, well, they had titanium wheels, they had this, they had that. You look at, but you look at what went into it and you're like, did we need to be spending, so they sent four up, so the development costs were part of the overall NASA project, so I've heard that carved out at Florida, but at the material production costs at $40 million a piece, okay, if you're looking at $10 million per rover. That also shows you what happened to everything else. Do we think that that's, now granted, they're like, well, it has titanium wheels, it has this, it has all this sort of, yeah, it might be overbuilt. I don't know. Point is, though, putting things into a vacuum, into that, you know, that, you know, you have to have them electric and the bat. I get that, but it's like, do we think that that's really what it would cost to do that if, you know, I don't know, like, what, how much do you think SpaceX is going to spend on theirs?
I'll tell you this much, whatever they spend, the first generation will be more expensive than the second generation, than the third generation, and so on and so on and so on. I mean,
and beyond that, the question of like, okay, well, how much would NASA spend on whatever SpaceX is going to spend, like that is already spending on a Mars rocket, right? Like, the answer is probably so much so that we're never going to spend it because it would be so onerous to the federal budget that it would never be able to get off the ground. So I think that that's the fascinating element of where we are right now with space and having a company that is specifically dedicated to getting prices getting efficiency in a relatively inefficient market because it was so expensive to get into it to begin with.
Yeah, they have incentives, of course, we talk about doing that. And that's what's going to be interesting. And again, the good thing is we have SpaceX and Blue Origin both working there. And Blue Origin is funded by the richest man in the world, which
who, by the way, got to be the richest man in the world because he figured out the most cost-effective way to move objects from point A to point B. Now he has a new quest to move objects from point A to point B. And just point B happens to be maybe a little bit more ambitious than, you know, from Connecticut to Cincinnati.
Yeah. This is a guy's life's ambition is stated ambition is to make humanity an interplanetary, you know, millions of people living and working in space, which... You know, when it's the richest man in the world saying that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, if we go back to the moment everything changes with Sputnik, right? That all of a sudden it goes from, eventually to, oh, my God. Yes. No, we need to do this immediately because now it's possible that we could have death from above and there's nothing that we can do about it. And we're not even on that playing field. Then yeah, look, there's everything can kind of change in a second when it comes to new frontiers. As soon as you demonstrate that it's possible, then all of a sudden the world is different. And that's to be fair, that's kind of why I thought like the Space Force thing was a good idea because it's like, yeah, you want to know what? For anybody who's like, hey, this is a really, really bad idea now, man, we're like one headline away from it being, oh, thank God we set up Space Force a year ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. Man, that's a wild thing. Hold on. I'm imagining, and I'm going to phrase all of this in the abstract. What if a self-avowed terrorist organization said, hey, guess what? Everything's cheap on the internet. And for a mere $3 million, we've placed 17 satellites in orbit that can chunk down some nasty ordnance or knock out all telecommunications on the planet by creating a debris cloud of, you know, of flak that'll, you know, like the movie Gravity or whatever. It does feel like whether or not they've even done those things, that kind of announcement, if it's credible or feels credible, would suddenly make me real happy to have a Space Force.
There's been a couple things that have happened in space that didn't get as much public attention because the public story of what happened we're not quite clear about. One was there was, you know, a Chinese satellite that in the process of maybe deorbiting took out like other satellites, damaged other satellites, and it was supposed to be an accident, but there was a suspicion that maybe it wasn't. And then they've had there's been a Russian satellite that's been changing positions at sort of a weird erratic sort of level, which sounds a lot. These all happen to be like state controlled vehicles, and it's not something we've seen with like communication satellites. So we're already in a position now where we have our X-37, we have our own stuff up there. We have our own capabilities and I've heard, you know, crazy stuff, but like that part of it's already started.
Do you think
not the terrorist part, but yeah.
Do you think that quietly, and of course we're speaking from the American perspective here, do you think quietly the military has been developing hardline redundancies in the possibility of some kind of, like, let's say all the satellites just get zapped at the same time. We still have some ability for intercommunication. I mean, I know that's quite literally the founding philosophy of the internet, but in the meanwhile, you know, so much of it relies on satellite, you know, retransmissions. I gotta believe that there's stuff that quote-unquote nobody or no normal citizen knows about. There's got to be plans in place for what happens if somebody were to try to knock out all of our communications.
Well, sort of, like, yeah. And so you'd mention, like, hard lines. You can't, like, you know, one of the biggest back for communication systems, one of the reasons AT&T had a government-backed monopoly for so long is because they did so much secret stuff for them. So, you know, Sandia Labs was, the government went to AT&T and said, hey, start a laboratory to, like, do research for us. Like, the whole history of that is fascinating about, you know, how much of that is you know, AT&T in many ways was really kind of a government fiat, you know, and the ways that it behaved in building some of these secret things. And that was why they were able to get away from from having to be split up for so long. And even though it flew afoul of so many rules, they were the one company that, like, no, they're special and different. But anyhow, that's part of it. But what you still are going to need orbital stuff, because you got people at war in the war theater where you can't run, you know, hard lines to places there. But that, you know, we work a laser, line of sight, all these other sorts of things. But one of the biggest things that's happening now, and one of the reasons why a lot of people are bullish on the future of SpaceX and Blue Origin. Blue Origin, by the way, the engine there, I think their Vulcan engine, the Vulcan rocket program, I think, selected their engine, the BA, forget the engine name right now, selected the engine they made to be used in the next generation vehicle. So Blue Origin won't just be making engines for their own spaceships, they'll be making them for other companies too. People are bullish on SpaceX and Blue Origin because if you look at the requirements now that the BE-4, thank you, Bryce. If you look at the requirements now and you look at what the Air Force is saying, hey, we want, and some of the other agencies are looking for now, they talk about, hey, we want rapid access to space. We want rapidly, you know, be able to get things up in space very, very quickly. For that case, you had mentioned exactly, Brian, because all of a sudden somebody takes out our communication satellites. We don't want to be in a position where we can't communicate. So that's a big, big driver right now, is fast access. Let's launch something, you know, in 24 hours. That was one of the reasons, by the way, we use solid rocket boosters in space for commercial space. We still use those as assists, like the SLS will have them, the space shuttle to use them. They're helpful. They're problematic, though, because they're dangerous and you can't control them. But the reason we use solid rocket boosters is that you could, from missile technology, because you can put a missile with a solid rocket booster in a silo and leave it there, you know, for months, for years, and then come back light.
Nothing has to be maintained. Everything's ready to go, and you just flip a switch.
Yep. Well, you know, we need you to flip a switch.
Yeah, the money switch, baby. And the switch turns on the fountain of money for us to live. It's me, Justin Robert Young from Weird Things. Hi, that was a character that I was playing called the Money Guy. If you want to support this very fun and interesting podcast, Weird Things, well, you can head on over to patreon.com/weirdthings, which is where you can go ahead and kick in a few dollars to make sure that we keep this show on the road. patreon.com/weirdthings.
Gentlemen, what washed ashore?
Oh boy. Can I guess?
No, this, not allowed to guess on the show, Brian.
Okay. Well, here's I saw a thing that I hope this is not what you were teeing up, because it's a separate side awesome story. It was a shark that washed ashore. And this girl walks up and realizes it's going to be beached and die. And so she walks up to a shark, like a 6-foot nurse shark, it looked like to me, and drags it into the water in the waves until finally it's able to start swimming and get control. Like, she saved a shark's life. It was freaking amazing. It was on Reddit.
Nice. No.
Oh, okay.
All right. Was it a carcass of some sort?
No, it was alive. All right, ready? Florida beachgoer spotted a rather unusual creature Tuesday emerging from the ocean. And a possible
I wish I could convey to the audio listeners the quizzical look on Andrew's face as he struggles to put words to it. This is where?
Florida.
Okay. All right. Justin, you're our resident Florida expert.
So alive, I mean, I would assume it's something that's not native to Florida, right? So, because all sorts of stuff floats ashore in Florida and might be a little bit weird.
Dead Polymers in the chat says a sea squatch, which I love.
I used to insist on calling the skunk ape. That was our Florida's Bigfoot, the swamp squatch.
Swamp squatch. I like sea squatch though. That's pretty good.
Yeah. So I'm going to say a polar bear.
No way.
Lost.
Yeah.
Okay, and it washed ashore, was it still alive when it washed ashore?
Yes.
Was it a person?
No.
Oh, okay. All right.
Person swims ashore.
Well, I mean, like, you know, I don't know, like a castaway, like, you know, a shipwreck, and, you know, he figures out how to make fire and all that stuff.
Our neighborhood got invaded by Russians once. That was...
pause everything. Quick well, sidebar. Let's talk about this.
So it was back in the 90s. I lived in Plantation, Florida, right next to where Justin grew up too. Canals. Our house was in canals. So we had an ocean access canal. So, you know, that was our thing. You know, hop in a little boat, go somewhere, whatever. One day our neighbors have a backyard full of Russian sailors because some Russian sailors took the little dinghy out from their boat. They were docked in like Fort Lauderdale and decided to go take a little tour of Florida. And they got lost in those. You look at the canals on a map. You look at how like this, they got lost. They pulled up to the back of a house. They're like, excuse me. Can you be helping us find our way? You know, they're like, oh yeah, let's pick. And there's like just a bunch of Russian sailors standing in their backyard.
That is amazing. And it's like, yeah. Meanwhile, like I would love to believe that these Floridians were treating them like alien visitors. They're like, you like them vodka? I bring vodka.
Yeah. Oh yeah, we had a party. I mean, this neighborhood, I'm sure, you know, the Jimmy Buffett's, you know, was playing and the margaritas were flowing. You know, they're like, you know, so. But yeah, it was just this like, oh, you're what, you know, see what over there. And you look over there and they see them, the uniform, like, and they were, it was like, wow, like, this is like the craziest thing. And Russia, a bunch of Russian sailors, like, just go.
To go from docked in Fort Lauderdale deep, I mean, to where Andrew grew up is like, that's, if you're obeying the wake zone restrictions, like, That's a solid like half hour. That's like a half hour, 40 minutes to traverse all those very intricate intracoastal canals.
Yeah.
So back to what washed up. It's not a human being. Justin, your vote was
polar bear.
Polar bear. I'm gonna. This is the weird thing show, so I want to say something like a giant squid or a killer whale, but those aren't weird enough. And it was alive. It was alive?
Yes.
Question. Does it belong normally in the sea?
No.
It was a horse. It was a horse.
I would like to see that.
Yeah. Horse. People pay good money to take a picture on a horse by a beach. Like you'd have tourists throwing you $30 in a Polaroid camera.
Especially if you painted it like a zebra and told everyone it was a zebra.
Bryce, I'm sure you already know the answer.
I believe I found a lot of stuff washed on shores this past week.
I love the fact that that was the confounding factor. Is like, man, a lot of stuff washed
Florida,
ashore.
Florida nailed it down, but yeah, I think I found it.
This is over on the Night Attack show, we joked about how one of the best Google News searches you can have is, quote, apologizes for, end quote. So I would add to that list, quote, washes ashore.
Yeah. That's a great one. The answer is, guys, there are only two choices here.
Snakes, monkeys.
Gosh darn it.
rattlesnake.
Oh my God. Wait, how did a rattlesnake end up in the ocean?
Oh, that's, I mean, that, I don't even know why that made the news. Like, come on. Yeah, you got some drug dealer on a boat and he gets a little too excited and accidentally drops a snake in the ocean.
Remember that Korean news agency that would do the reenactments? I will put down the first $100 to a Justin Patreon account where he explains why stuff happened and we show like videos, recreations, drug deal in the back holding a rattlesnake by its neck.
Oh, I mean, come on, yeah.
It's cocaine. Oh.
He's trying to make a metaphor, and he's punctuating his sentences by firing a solid gold Desert Eagle into the air or in the ocean, and he accidentally gets startled and drops his snake. And next thing, bada bing, bang, boom, snake washes up to shore.
True story. That's the real reason that the Marie Celeste was empty when you got there. Somebody was doing exactly that, and he dropped a snake in the boat. Everybody jumped out, including the snake, and so there's nobody on there.
It's stranger things could happen.
So no explanation is forthcoming. This is a genuine ass mystery.
If I had to guess, the thing probably got washed out to sea, and then
tide comes in, sweeps it when it's not looking.
Yeah, it was like, man, like this sucks.
Oh, I just gotta keep snake in my snake ways.
He's like, I think I see some people. Hey guys, hey guys.
He's got a spare mouse.
And then some girl threw him back into the ocean.
The snakes come in, the snakes come out. The snakes play pinochle on Florida's snout.
Yeah. Snakes come in, snakes come out. Can't explain that.
A philosophical question here, then. Moving on. All right. So we have 10 years ago, SpaceX launches.
Yeah.
You know, they built their own engine, which is sort of a key thing. Part of the reason the success of SpaceX was they said, we think the engines could be better. And people are like, you're arrogant. You know, they've been building these engines for years. What do you think you're doing? And then it was like, you know, Elon Musk with Tesla, like, build a better battery. You know, if you figure out the battery tech, you know, that's a big part of it. We're seeing incredible developments there. I've been blown away by what I've seen in artificial intelligence. Like every few years we get some amazing development. Like a thing that happened in AI that was a big, 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 big thing that was an academic thing and it worked its way into tech and now it's everywhere and all that. And we go, well, yeah, of course. And that was solving vision. Like AI vision is insane. And we showed before, I showed like the algorithm, like you only look once, which was, you know, this neural net, which is very, very fast identifying things, which 15 years ago, just even 10 years ago, would have been amazing.
Totally science fiction back in the day.
Yeah. Now your phone in the background processes your images, identifies, you know, who's what, whatever. We solved the vision thing because we came up with, part of it comes down to, it's not just brute force using computational power. It comes down to often using how you process these images and stuff, how you do this sort of stuff, right? So vision was a big development in AI. Now we put vision into everything. You know, like Facebook is using vision recognition to look at all the products in your photos you upload to Instagram to see what your buying habits are and all this. And this is often where these things happen. There are other developments coming in technology and AI and stuff that are, you know, amazing. I showed previous week, I showed the 3D sense on the iPhone, right? And showed you how, you know, it was able to see the side of my face through the
right.
map.
Just looking at you face on, it was able to build a 3D map that was good enough that after the fact, you were able to move it around and we were able to see sides of your face.
Real time. Yeah. I mean, the real time do that. I mean, that's, you know, the real time processing there is incredible. And it was funny, I was playing around with it in the dark. And there's a mode where you use it in the dark and it looks like predator vision because it's just, you know, that. And these are coming at us from all different directions and stuff, these technologies. And so, you know, one of the things that amazes me is like if you look inside of, let's say, like the Pixel 2 or the iPhone, and you look at that camera technology is incredible. You have within one cubic centimeter, you have something that blows away, you know, commercial photography or, you know, photographic systems, you know, from just a couple years ago. Like, it used to be that, you know, camera technology was like one of the things that, the government was like had strong export licensing, preventing it from, because that was like spy tech and stuff, like satellite stuff. But anyhow, it's incredible. Billions of dollars technology inside of there. Now we have cameras that take 3D images, things like this we didn't even conceive of. My question, do we need to be – what else could we be dreaming bigger about? What else are stuff that we could be doing and things that could happen, you know?
I'm very dialed in on my increasing understanding of how programmable, even in, you know, at my advanced decrepit age, our silly wetware is in terms of setting up incentives to create habits and stuff. And I think we've talked about this before, but we can program Alexa and Siri to program us. So it's like previous to this, there are commitment devices like writing goals or hiring a trainer or sticking to a program or whatever. These are exterior structures that we would build that in a crude format caused us to generally pick more good choices than bad choices. I feel like now we have the AI ability. When we have these AIs who have the access to our entire back catalog of behaviors, then they can set up a bunch of tiny little nudges to get us to do the right thing. For example, imagine, I don't know, this is some kind of version of AI helicopter parenting, but when your AI knows that you have a script due tomorrow, and it knows that in general you have a tendency to just want to watch one more episode of The Good Place, the AI can nudge you ever so softly when you hit like, hey, let me watch The Good Place. It could take just a little bit longer than is necessary for it to do. And then also at that exact moment, pop up with a reminder that your thing is due tomorrow. Like right now we rely on random happenstance to make all of that happen. And I feel like we can cause our own realities to make us be the best versions of ourselves in the future. That's where I think there's not a lot of talk or not a lot of encouragement or embracing of that possibility.
I'm going to say I like that idea. We talked a bit a while ago about the leaked Google video, the whole video of like how the AI technology, whatever, could be used to make your life better. I forgot the name of it.
The Selfish Ledger.
Yeah, the Selfish Ledger. They took like that. So the Selfish Ledger, right? And, you know, my issue with that was, besides it being extremely creepy and we have no reason to trust Google at all, you know, as any institution, let me not just, but I mean, specifically a, you know, marketing company that makes their money by using your data, you know.
By selling your attention to other people. By the way, holy cow, we didn't even get to the whole Facebook news of the last week, but we could put
we can get in it. And so, like, I'll just say, like, my issue with this, my problem with this is that we can say, like, yeah, it'd be great. I can have AI help me plan these things. I think that's great. I think that is an admirable goal we should work for. You look at the new Apple Watch, and, like, I was like, man, it can monitor from having a heart attack. Like, this is amazing. This sounds really attractive to me. My concern is this, is I've seen companies say, hey, yeah, we want to encourage people to be healthy because of this research that we then find out a couple years later is bogus. Now, we changed the entire school program, school lunch programs in the United States. We changed the dietary guidelines based upon, in many ways, and the way we did things based upon some research that came out of one institution that we're now finding out is bogus. We're now finding out the claims and stuff about that they said about how to get kids to eat, what they should eat, whatever, was fabricated, cannot be replicated, whatever. But we took it as, and it's like people go, I believe science. I believe evidence. I can write science on anything and tell you it's science, but if the evidence is not there, it's not really science. And that's my fear.
Which sea change are you referring to? Like the institution of the four food groups or the food pyramid or is this? I don't know much about the story you're alluding to.
There was a research more recently, the last 10 years or so, 15 years, coming out like, oh, change the names of food and children are more likely to eat it. And this is how you do this. And there's a lot of that stuff. The stuff that formed
they're called adventure pods, not apples. Yeah. Go for it.
way more than that. You know, the government's sort of, you know, positions on fat completely wrong. Like the stuff they still say is just not borne out by the evidence, salt intake, whatever. Evidence is opposite, but you have a few people who've been in charge of, you know, in charge of those programs and stuff who've staked their reputation on this research, and they're the ones that get to change these guidelines or not, won't give up on that. And you have like people, somebody actually mentioned, like, you know, Big Sugar, like we have the influence of different industries, you know, different corporations, you know, are able to, you know, I don't care what political system you have, there's going to be power, and there's right. going to be power to be bought.
In the book, Salt, Sugar, Fat, there's a section talking about how the American Dairy Board, you know, basically got to the place where they had more dairy than they knew what to do with. And because milk expires, they had to figure out, like, okay, what's a thing that we can induce American society to adopt? And so up until that point, cheese was always considered a standalone delicacy, but there was a considered effort to figure out a way to get Americans to consider cheese as an ingredient. So now all of a sudden they have something to do with all this dairy because cheese lasts longer than milk and so on. So it's like, I mean, that's not, it sounds like crazy conspiracy theory stuff, but that's a real thing that happened. And, you know, it's up for debate and discussion whether or not humanity is better off as a result of all that.
Yeah, and it's the danger comes into it's not influence will never go away. And we could say, hey, we want a system where we're going to prevent this. And, you know, you could say, oh, we'll go for a much more tightly regulated system, let's say like Europe has in some regards. And then you get Dieselgate, you know, and then you get these other things. And so I don't the perfect answer. I'm not here to say it's this or this, but it is knowing what's going in. It's like people want to know the ingredients of their food. You want to know where these decisions are coming from. We want to know the quality of the research, and we don't just want to stamp labels on it and go, well, it says Harvard here, or hear this, or whatever. You want to know, we need to ask questions. Why? Why are we sure? Are we sure? Are we sure? We need to not be afraid, and we shouldn't be shut down if we're going to war. Are we sure? That being said, like, yeah, I think, like Brian, like AI is helping making decisions be great. It's just, you know, the scary thing to me is when it's like,
I bet China has very specific thoughts about how useful and wonderful that technology can be used.
Oh my God. You know, and that's, can I just say, like, I'm really glad when actors step forward and point out when somebody says something silly or stupid, but this is a side jag, but like, I've yet to hear a Marvel actor ask what happened to Fan Bing Bing. Just saying.
I don't know what you're referring to.
The whole of the China situation. How China's very powerful, but like nobody in entertainment.
Got it.
Nobody in entertainment will say anything about it because they're like buying up so much American product. And it's like, you know, we had a big blow up because, you know, hey, Kanye managed to upset everybody. And everybody's like on Kanye's case. I'm like, okay, but like, you know, like how come nobody's saying like, hey, one of the most most successful box office star in the world from China, Fan Bing Bing, vanished. Nobody's bringing that up. Nobody's saying, hey, China, what happened to her?
You know. So Justin, what unasked questions?
Sorry. You said the China word.
Right? The other C word.
Certainly, there's certainly nobody in Brian's orbit who learned very, very fast. Don't talk about China publicly, or else you will have to have your sad faced portrait in the New York Times.
Oh yeah. A friend of ours has written some movies and spoke candidly and freewheelingly, and
even mentioning we have to make sure that we don't upset China was something that could not be said publicly. Like, of course not. No, geez, no, that's insane. But see, you make a sad face, put it in the New York Times.
Yeah, we'll go into this a little bit after things. I apologize for that side jag there, but yeah.
But meanwhile, in the general category of as we talk about like what's possible with artificial intelligence that we haven't considered before.
I really like, to me, and this is something that I've talked with Andrew ad nauseum about, and it's something that I feel like should be a thing here now is the audio internet and take specifically now that we have voice assistants at the position that we do now and they are kind of ubiquitous, the idea of keeping them with us in a way. I mean, I guess it's a shame that, you know, Amazon being as successful as they are with the Echo isn't where Apple is with Siri, in that, like, I just want headphones where I can do so much via just like an always going, like whenever I have headphones in, just a more Echo Assistant-esque kind of conversation back and forth on where I'm at, where my day is. And that's where I think, to me, Brian, I don't view, you know, I think your AI example is very, very interesting in that we volunteer constantly ourselves into systems that are designed to make us more efficient. We do that in school. We do that in work and management structures. You know, the three of us have decided to take a more nomadic path through life, but that there is a lot of times that you seek for a structure that can optimize you. And I think that, to me, is something that AI can fill in as we opt into, like, hey, I want to get this project done. And then the AI says, cool, based on my template for how to get this project done, these are your tasks. I put it on your calendar. I'm now going to remind you as you go along to make sure that this happens. Or based on, like, congratulations, like, based on, you know, averages, you're going faster. Or, sorry, man, you're going slower on this than you should. If you want to be done by this time, then you need to start working at this. If you want to lose X amount of pounds, you have to make sure that you log in at the gym, today. You can't skip, yada, yada, yada. So I think, to me, that is something that audio wise, considering how often we walk around with, you know, buds in our ears, or we have some kind of speaker that can talk to us, that to me, a more all-encompassing ecosystem there and development there is something that I don't know if it classifies as have to dream bigger, but I do wonder why we're not there more. We're not closer to there now.
You know, I've been thinking about, like, the audio internet for a long time and how useful it would be. And a lot of, you know, the ideas, things I wanted to see, now we have an Echo and Siri and OK Google and all that. But one of the problems is to try to get the same kind of functionality we have now. There are, like, audio assist programs and stuff that will read web pages. And if you use, like, voice assist and stuff, it'll call out properly formatted HTML, will tell you what the buttons are and this are. But it's tedious. If you're able to look at a screen, you look at a screen and you got 15 options, it takes you a second to see it, process it, and decide, I'm clicking here. If yes. You're trying to do that with audio, it's either we have to say we use it in a very, very different way, where the AI is making choices for us, or we have to radically think the paradigm of how we can get 10 menu choices at once.
This is one of those things that's covered in the book Homo Deus, where you know, the trend will be we increasingly rely on our algorithms, who we trust to do things. Like, first we're going to rely on algorithms to help us parse our own thoughts about politics and which is the best candidate. Which do I value more, this person or that person? Or do I value this, you know, liberty versus oppression more than I value, you know, sanctity versus corruption? Do I value, you know, care, harm, So at first we're going to consult like an oracle, but at some point we're going to question, like, why am I the dumb meat body that has to take half a day to go show up at the polls? Could we please have my algorithm just do this for me? Sorry, it looks like you got something there.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think there's, you know, the idea of the algorithms helping sorting and make choices, but I've not read that book, but I'm familiar with that argument. My problem with that argument is that it is the, you know, we're all rational actors, so this is the rational thing we're going to do. But that's not how we choose. Or, you know, we take the poll, the survey, who do you most agree with? Oh, I most agree with this person. You know what? But that guy dresses like a slob, don't like him, I'm going to vote for this other guy.
Right. Well, and that's one of the points in Homo Deus is that we will increasingly rely on algorithms to keep us in check so that we don't make irrational. So your algorithm will say, hey, according to, you know, the numbers, based on the amount of physical activity you've had, looking at your schedule, it looks like there's a strong chance that you're going to not turn up at the polls next Thursday. So what I went ahead and put on your calendar, knowing you, like I know you, it's me, your algorithm. I went ahead and put today, you're just going to go vote early so you can knock it out. You know, it's like.
I hear. And I guess my again, it's a, you know, we're all into the idea that we all are rational actors and we'll make those choose those things in a rational way. But you know what? My friend told me there's going to be a debate tomorrow night. Maybe I should watch. I mean, I think AI can help us. Yes. I think AI can help us be better. Like, hey, every time I get a paycheck, automatically deposit this and do these things. Preference choices are harder though, because you can tell somebody you like this, everything about you says you like this, this is the right thing. And then we resist it. And it's the weird, it's like many doctors do not like Watson or AI assisting with diagnoses and stuff. Cause it's like, once you've taken that away from me, and that's the weird, I don't know. I just assume that.
I tend to believe that the pathway we will follow, whether or not it ends with AI doing more decision-making for us, is that AI is going to be there for optimizing our own thinking, mm-hmm. right? That is, to me, the very obvious gateway of trying us continually asking more of AI so it does what we want to do faster and better and makes us faster and better. And then at that point, then Brian, I see where you're going, that it's like, okay, well, I've asked the same question, the same questions a million times, and now it's like, okay, well, also this one candidate matches your opinions 90% or 99%. Like, would you also like to put him or her on your watch list? I don't know why we're making a watch list for you.
or just on your radar or whatever.
So yeah. I think, Brian, like, that's the best case scenario. I'm all for that. The problem we have right now, two of the biggest users of artificial intelligence in daily life are Google and Facebook.
Yeah.
And we just found out, Facebook, hey, you know that phone number? Like, we need a phone number for security purposes to lock down your account. They were asked flat out by like New York Times, whatever. Like, hey, do you use this for advertising purposes to link to accounts? Like, no, we did not do that. Researchers did some research, looked in there, tried phone numbers to see if they popped up advertising, found out they're linking them to advertising. And Google's or Facebook's like, yeah, no, we link it to advertising. And you're like, wait, you just said you don't. And now you just said you do. And it's like, and they found out too, that like, I've talked about this before, people like, oh, we should be able to erase your identity or portability of your data on Facebook. And I've talked about shadow accounts. I'm like, there's that data in their folder, but then there's this every time Brian uploads an Instagram photo with Justin in it, they know you two are friends. They know your contacts. If you put Justin's phone number in as a contact or this or whatever, they've got their own. And that's not part of your data. That's, quote, their data that they have about you. And they've got that. You're in the system. I'm in the, you know, if you're not on Facebook, you're still in the system because somebody somewhere, you know, what? You know, it's help.
And that is the, let's remove the AI type of things out of everything. Let's time travel back to 1967 and you have enough money that you can hire a private investigator to find out like, hey, somebody's harassing my employees. Will you find out who they are and try to figure out what motivates him to do this? Will you find out who his friends are and all that stuff? Like, certainly there's a place for that. And then meanwhile, somebody follows somebody around and finds out a whole bunch of stuff. Like, now we're able to get that for not just pennies on the dollars, but freaking pennies on the millions of dollars. And as a result, this is the part that I'm loath to admit, but it is Facebook's data in that they're hiring billions of little private detectives to piece together a narrative and story that helps, that gives them information that they can sell to the highest bidder, which, by the way, is one of the creepy things about Facebook.
Well, certainly so. I don't think that it's necessarily, you know, we have an evolving thought on data. And this, I think, is a general problem for Facebook going forward, is they have an issue of the A, people got into Facebook for very human reasons, for connections and yada, yada, yada. The more that people understand about how we got there in general, and this is anecdotally, the more people I feel uneasy about it or don't feel comfortable with their ability to control, you know, what this is and whether and then they start to make the calculations in their head of, OK, well, is this worth it? Do I like it? Do I get enough out of it to have this amount of data used this kind of way by this company? And so when we talk about going forward and now thinking of like, OK, well, maybe Facebook can say, so understand that we're kind of creepy. However, nobody knows you like I know you. Nobody can make you a better person like I can make you a better person, because nobody has the head start in the data like I do. So sure, is it weird? Is it creepy? I mean, that was your fault because you weren't an engineer when we were. And so like, yeah, we weren't hiding anything from you. We were just gods and you were just peons. But now that we're all here on Olympus, let's understand that
the only thing creepier than your argument is the fact that I would fall for it, that it's very seductive. Like, I'm just like, well, I mean, we are here and you do have my last 10 years of activity. And I mean, I'm starting over from scratch and, you know, with a brand new relationship that might be just as abusive as this one.
Have you guys looked at myaccount.google/purchases?
Uh-oh.
I just sent you a link.
So, you know, Google keeps a good track record of it, depending on like the location data you have, so it can know, oh, you were here at this point, or search history. You searched this X, Y, or Z at this point. This is creepy to me because I don't have an Android phone and I don't use the Google Pay system.
Holy crap.
Ever. But there are, I'm just looking at the top three items on here, and these are things that went through my email as receipts. And so
yeah, every email that goes through that involves a purchase, Google catalogs it, has a database of this information.
Oh my
God. And it's everything. It's Amazon stuff, iTunes, Postmates. I spent $100 at Eastside King. When did I do that?
Pokemon Mystery Dungeon. When did I buy that?
it's just a convenient thing.
My word. This is an astonishingly precise. I could tell. I just realized that I'm logged in as Bonnie because I'm seeing Picasso books. And
Only that, it's smart enough to know like when it was fulfilled and where it shipped to, and it can break out the tax and all this stuff, because all this stuff is coming in as text over Gmail. But
the important thing is that apparently I was logged in as Bonnie when I bought 15 classic packs of Hearthstone.
That sounds about right.
So you're like, they didn't collect this data. There are two reasons to Google collected this data.
Okay.
One is the obvious, like, well, they want to know what you buy so they can advertise to you and all this. The other reason they collect this data, and I didn't know this existed till like a couple of days ago. The other reason they collect this data is because when Google sells advertising, let's say they sell advertising to, you know, Marvel to advertise the newest Marvel movie, they want to prove that if you bought the item, or if you go look at, you know, Crate and Barrel, you know, fancy candlesticks and they advertise to you, Google wants to show advertisers that, yes, this worked. That this ad worked, that we showed this is why they bought it. Because if you don't buy it online or you buy it through some other means, Google wants credit for their ad. They're the world's largest advertising company, and their customer is advertisers. So they collect this data for their advertisers, not for our benefit, not to help us.
I spent $27 on Barbie Dreamhouse Adventures Puppies Pack.
That sounds right.
What is going on?
That tracks.
Man, I hate this.
Yeah, right. All of a sudden, I want to go take a shower. This is really,
this is why it works. This is why they have built these incredibly successful companies. I mean, understand this. Facebook and Google killed the modern advertising industry. A modern advertising industry lasted as long as mass media existed, which, like, let's begin with newspapers, spin it up into magazines, radio, television,
all that. It all went through the same channels of you go to an advertising, you know, company, you get your advertising made, you sell it to the following channels. That is rapidly atrophying and devolving to the point where the kings of the industry, the unbeatable titans that beat that built media conglomerates, are now tailoring their upfront presentations to why we still matter. Please continue to advertise with us. Why? Because on the other end, the wolves are lower cost, higher targeting. And to get that, you need all of what you are looking at right now in horror, because they know exactly how many puppy packs you bought from Barbie.
And knows that I bought Denizen from Levi's 32x30s. Oh my goodness,
Denizens, those are good jeans.
Yeah, no, they are. They flex a little bit.
They got a little flex, but they fill. Yeah, they're good.
Yeah.
So, and this is what we publicly know. And it's funny because you read their policy, like, who can see your orders? Only you can see your orders. That's not a complete answer. And it's like Facebook. Like Facebook's, you know, now we're getting into, you know, Google was working on Project Snapdragon, which was, or Dragonfly rather. Dragonfly was Google building a search engine for China because Google's still not in China. And apparently Google had hundreds of engineers building a search engine for China that would, in China, certain topics you're not allowed to say, like Tibet, Tiananmen Square anniversary, Winnie the Pooh. And Google was building a search engine that would prevent those from being there. And it's one thing to say, you know what, when you're in another country and there's certain laws and customs, maybe you should abide by that. But they also were going to tie, in order to use the search engine, it was all going to be tied into your phone number and the idea that the government would have access to whoever said this. And it's like probably a good after things conversation. We'll talk about that. So
yeah,
table that.
Speaking of which, I do have a hard out in a few minutes. If we can jump over to picks, I have a pick that I am deeply in love with. Ladies and gentlemen, finally got around to actually playing the new Spider-Man video game. It's the best thing on the planet. It's amazing. I strongly encourage you, Andrew Main, to quit writing books and do nothing but get a perfect 100% completion on it.
Oh boy, it looks beautiful. It's absolutely gorgeous.
The story is great. The cinematics are great. It's so much fun for me to play with the kids because, you know, there's logic puzzles that Penny, you know, we hand her the controllers, and then there's, you know, get from point A to point B, and that's a moment that our 5-year-old can just web sling, and you know, it takes her a while to get there, but she gets there, and it's fun and funny. And then, oh crap, there's a battle. Hand the controller to Dad, and it's like,
great.
It's amazing. It's one of the best video game narrative experiences I've had in years and years and years. It's great.
And the story is really solid. I mean, I think we talked about this
There's a character. Stop me if you've heard this before or seen literally any Spider-Man anything anywhere. There's somebody that Peter Parker works with who you know will not always end
this
up
was
being.
Justin's comment on his pick.
Like there's somebody that Peter Parker works with that you know, like that's the name of somebody who turns out to be a bad guy.
Sure.
But we're still in the early phases of the game where it's like he's really sweet and look at him. Oh, and he's like, I don't know. It's great.
I don't even know that. I am like halfway through that game, and I don't know that that guy makes that turn.
Really?
I don't know if he does or not.
Really?
I know that there are a lot of villains in this game, but I know that there are a lot of Spider-Man characters in this game.
I got upset with my daughter for getting to a mission objective too quick, and I didn't get to hear the rest of the J. Jonah Jameson podcast. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, if you missed it, J. Jonah Jameson does not work at the Daily Bugle. He runs a podcast that is very much InfoWars Alex Jonesian.
It's amazing.
It's very funny. Because he gets dunked on constantly by the people he calls in. Like, oh, this guy had an encounter with Spider-Man. Put him on. And the guy's like, oh, yeah, Spider-Man was great. Like, hang up!
It's way, way good. If you have a PlayStation 4, highly recommended.
Yeah.
Justin?
I got a pick. We got done with The Good Place. Liked it. It's great. Watch the first episode of the new season on regular-ass TV. That's not as fun, but I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about the show that we started watching afterward, which we're only 2 episodes into. However,
It's called Maniac.
Oh, yes, Maniac. Mm.
It is a limited series for Netflix. It stars Emma Stone and
Jonah Hill.
Yeah, Jonah Hill. And I'm two episodes in, and I have not gotten to the part that literally is populates all the trailers, which I assume at this point I kind of know is coming. But man, is it just fun? We're just in such a fun place in TV right now that you can get Academy Award winning actors to do a project that's a little bit off kilter. It's a little bit strange and weird. The world building is fantastic. I don't know if it's fantastic in that like it's a credible world, but it's a near future with a near past aesthetic that I think is certainly pleasing to the eye. And you know, we'll see. It's incredibly well crafted, and I've enjoyed the first two episodes so far. I'm excited to see where it goes. This is definitely on the thin Jonah side.
Yeah.
Of thin Jonah, fat Jonah dynamic.
Directed and co-created by Kara Jojo Fukugawa, who directed first season of True Detective and is now directing and I believe writing the next James Bond movie.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah.
I finished watching this over the weekend because I was like enraptured by it. It definitely feels like a very creative sort of show in terms of like mixing in sci-fi and slightly dystopic elements, but it's really creative, and it gives them a good reason to do all these very specific vignettes that are out of genre, and I think it's a good time. And as far as like being a limited miniseries where they're not going to make any more of it, I think that's probably a good idea.
It's good. Not every idea has to go forever, and there's a lot of Netflix series that are you know, they hit, and then you're like, it would be legendary. I think that there's certainly more. Stranger Things is something that I think lends itself more to like, oh, I want to see what happens, you know, with this world. But man, if Stranger Things began and ended on that one season, it would still be a legendary moment where people would still be jumping up and down and screaming justice for Barb. Right. Yeah. And that's a thing that we don't get now that we have more of that story. And whether or not, you know, you like or you hate the second season, which I think we were all pretty mixed on. There's just something really, really cool about like, listen, the Maniac universe, if you're into hard sci-fi or you are mostly delighted by a sci-fi universe, a near world sci-fi universe where things connect a little bit more, this might not be for you. But it's there are fun, like there's no reason why in the near future with all these other things that everybody will be using CRT monitors. It's just kind of an aesthetic choice. Yeah. But there are little fun touches that are more about cool. The moment than they are about, you know, the universe that I think is cool. So check it out, Maniac. I mean, if anything, just watch it because, like, I want to support more top flight, like, you know, a big headline movie talent doing and top line directing and writer talent just getting a bag of money from Netflix to do six episodes of a cool idea. Like, I like all that.
Yeah, it's definitely worth going in blind as much as you can help it. Because there are just lots of great turns and surprises.
All right, enough. Nothing. We get to like recommend. I'm like, okay, I'm sold. And it's like, and then I'm like, okay. It's like my dad would go like, I saw this movie. I'm like, I'm gonna see it. And then my dad would give you, you're not bad like my dad. My dad will give you the plot.
Oh yeah.
And my brother and I have this joke. Well, thanks, Dad. You saved me $10. Bryce.
I have a pick that I only started watching today. I think for a lot of people, that's way too late because everybody, this is a beloved show. But I guess Netflix is doing some sort of co-production deal on The Great British Baking Show / The Great British Bake Off. And so now they're listing it as a Netflix original on Netflix. And it's a cooking competition show with bakers in England and them making different cakes and all sorts of pastries and stuff. It's really as far as like a cooking competition show goes, or any reality competition, it is it's a little gentler. But also, like, in the one episode that I saw, they were like three challenges in this hour long episode instead of two, which is a lot. You kind of go through everybody really quickly. But that stuff always starts to spreads out as more people leave. But it's a nice, more low key sort of reality show. It's not a lot of like inter-contestant drama like you would get on a Top Chef or like Road Rules sort of thing. So, but yeah, and Netflix has five of the seasons now, but I know that I read a press release when I was looking this up because I was interested in it being a Netflix original, and they were like, yes, we have Collection 1, which is season 4, and Collection 2, which is season 3, and it's like, because it's, there's still like a PBS deal, I guess. So it's you don't lose anything probably by watching them out of order like that, but I think it's really cool, and that's probably going to be my next like background thing is the Great British Baking Show / Bake Off.
Ruby, my pick. I spent part of last week working on a project and realizing I was doing it completely a stupid different way, and then a coding thing, and then I said, you know what? Maybe I had this epiphany, like maybe I should just do this all in Python. I went to Python, and I'm like, you know what? I really like Python. You know, I've been, and most people are like, what is he talking about? Like, if you want to learn a computer language, I recommend now learn JavaScript. JavaScript is great. JavaScript, you can do a lot of things now. You can build like if you want to learn Ruby on Rails, you're still going to have to use JavaScript to make the website do something. So learn JavaScript. But you can have JavaScript now run on servers. You can use JavaScript with React Native to make apps. You can learn to do a lot of great stuff with JavaScript. So I'm a big fan of, I think everybody should learn to code a little, you know, and we all took a little bit in school, but it's always good just to sort of do that. JavaScript is wonderful, but if you're looking for another one, like Python is great because Python, you can do a lot of cool things there. And I built like this whole application to go do some stuff. And it was just like, man, I should have done this to begin with. So I've mentioned this before. I go to Udemy. There are always great courses there, super cheap, $12. That's kind of like how other people buy a video game and get into it and play it. My thing is I buy a course and I spend a few weeks, you know, a few days, a few weeks, whatever, learning something. And then, you know, that's my thing. So, yeah, like it used to a couple of years ago, be like, what do you recommend? I'm like, well, Ruby's good. It's easy and all this. But then JavaScript has become so widespread and so useful for a lot of things. You know, you can do client side, server side, all of that. And a lot of these things may sound, what? Here is my thing. And this is for people who are maybe curious but afraid. If you go to, let's say, Udemy or use lynda.com, which is free for many people with a public library card, you can take a course on something knowing absolutely nothing about coding, knowing nothing. You can do a starter course, a beginner course. A week from now, you will be a different person. A week from now, you're going to have this capability. A week from now, it's not to mean you're going to be an expert, you're going to know everything, but a lot of these things were mysterious and opaque to you, you will understand. You'll understand how to find your answers to do stuff. You'll understand how to create an application on your program to get it run, on your computer and get it run, how to work with a server, how to do this stuff. 1 week can change your life considerably. Not to say you have to become a programmer or do that, but it will give you a capability and something you didn't have before. If you have a couple hours to spend every day for a couple days or a couple weeks, whatever, consider it. Just consider doing it because it changes the way you think. I have a friend that was in, had serious medical problems. And so he's been home, sitting at home for like a year and hasn't been able to do much. And I'm like, well, what about coding? He's like, I don't know. My computer, so I sent him a new computer. Send him a course. And I'm like, I'm not saying you need to become a coder, but like if I had the experience I had now 20 years ago, I'm not saying, I mean, my life turned out pretty well. I'm not complaining, but I would have had other opportunities. So
the phrase that rings in my mind is something that Brian Tracy said in one of his books is, you know, it's a challenging thing to aim for something that will happen 5 years from now or a goal of self-improvement. But he's fond of reminding people the time will pass anyway. So if the time's going to pass anyway, probably worth it to set yourself up to be a better person a year, 5 years from now.
Yeah, and it's as we as these things as our lives become more dependent upon computers and technology and AI and stuff like this, having the ability to understand a little bit more what's going on is helpful. It's super, super, super helpful. And it's just, you know, it's like, you know, car repairs kind of like got sophisticated and, you know, many of us don't repair a car, but it's still a good idea to know how a car works or how things work or what's going on there. But I particularly if you're a person trying to figure out what to do next, this is, oh man, you know, it's so, so helpful, so useful. So that's my pick. All right.
Awesome.
It's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.